AJ Wasserstein is a private investor with a long-term orientation, interested in lower middle market businesses and philanthropic organizations. AJ is also a professor at Yale School of Management, where he teaches several courses on SMB leadership, acquisitions, and entrepreneurship. AJ, welcome to the Circle of Competence podcast, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Victor and Benton, for inviting me. That's so kind and gracious of you, and I'm thrilled to be here.
Absolutely. So I just have to ask just a good starter question. What's your favorite class that you teach at Yale, and can we dig into why?
Yeah, that's such an unfair question to kick off with, Benton. That's like saying, which of my three kids do I love the most? So it's not fair. So you're kind to give me an opportunity to plug some of the work I do at Yale. I teach four courses at Yale. How about I identify the four courses and I'll share the favorite thing I like about each course? But you can't make me pick a favorite course. So that's not nice.
We started with a hard one.
Yeah, start with a tough one. I hope it gets easier from here. But I teach a course called Patterns in Entrepreneurship. And I teach that course in the beginning of the fall semester. And in that course, we explore six distinct ways that students could potentially become an entrepreneur. And I love that course because it really opens students' eyes and illuminates for them. There are lots of ways that someone can be an entrepreneur. And most people think about entrepreneurship as either Silicon Valley, venture capital, tech, or cool consumer products. So I try to expand that tent. And that's a really fun course. I like that a lot. I also teach a course called Entrepreneurship Through Acquisition, where we explore buying a business as a way to launch and catapult your entrepreneurial journey. I can't help but love that course because that's really my wheelhouse and my thing. So ton of fun. And that's great because students' eyes sort of pop open and realize that, wow, not only can I do this, but I don't have to have a crazy disintermediating idea. I don't have to disrupt an industry. I can do it now. So that's a ton of fun. I teach a course called Roll-ups, Consolidations, and Programmatic Acquisitions. Once again, I love this course because sort of right in my sweet spot, but this is a course about executing a strategy where you do multiple buys, a serial acquisition program to aggregate a scale organization. Ton of fun. Students really lean into that one. And the last class I teach is called Leading Small and Medium Enterprises. I think of this as the messy middle. It's not about starting or buying. It's not about exiting or leaving. It's innings 3 through 7, and it's all about the challenges and opportunities of building, growing a business, and on the operational, financial, human capital, information technology, just really what it feels like to be in the shoes of a CEO of a lower middle market business. Can I brag for a second?
Let's do it.
Okay, so three of my four classes have 50% or more female protagonists. So I work hard to make sure that the protagonist selection is representative of the school. Not perfect by any means, I assure you of that. But three of the four classes do have 50% or more female protagonists. And I think that matters a lot.
That's great. Yeah, that's one thing Victor and I have talked about. We would love to have, this is a shameless plug, we would love to have more great women guests. I've interviewed Trish Higgins, another real estate private equity investor out of LA, Monique Holmes, but we need some more ladies on the show. So if you've got any great guests that you might recommend, we can talk after. But back to your answer, If I might have detected a hint more enthusiasm for the second option. Is that true? What do you think? The second class that you mentioned.
Yeah. So, of course. So look, when I'm not in the halls of academia right now, so I'm allowed to have an opinion. When I teach my Patterns in Entrepreneurship course, I try to be very neutral. And my role is not to tell students what's best for them. And I never could, because there are different best answers for each individual student. But where is my heart? Where do I think there's an amazing risk-adjusted, lifestyle-adjusted, high probability of success? I think entrepreneurship through acquisition is an extraordinarily compelling road for many, many, many aspiring entrepreneurs. Not everyone, but many.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue. Maybe to take a step back and just tell the audience a little bit about what your background was, the two companies you were involved with before Yale, so they have a little bit more context for those who are not as familiar as Victor and I are with your background. So just maybe walk through the two companies that you were involved with and maybe why that may have biased your opinion for or towards ETA in the meantime.
The first company I ran was called Archives One, and this was a sleepy, boring business in the document storage industry. So we took customers' business records and medical records and stored those records in large warehouses. Our customers were banks, law firms, large corporations, and hospitals. Medical institution. So phenomenal business. So if you want me to stay here, Benton, I could dwell on Archives One for a few minutes, or we can move on.
I would like to dig in a little bit to Archives One.
Same.
The business itself, you guys were storing the like hard copies of documents in warehouses.
You are now an expert, Victor, in the industry. That is exactly what we did. The only part that was really hard, and I say this jokingly, is that periodically customers would call us up, email, or back then dating myself, fax, and ask us to retrieve a file or box. And when they asked us to retrieve a file or box, we did. So that's the whole industry. There you have it. We put boxes on shelves and stored them. And when people called to get the box or file back, we did so.
It was the physical cloud before the cloud.
That's right. It's a physical cloud. And there are lots of reasons why this was beyond a phenomenal industry. So as boring and sleepy as it looks on the veneer, this industry was amazing. And I loved it more than anything from a business perspective. It was just...
Well, why so? What made it so attractive?
Yeah, so lots of reasons. Fundamentally, I think about businesses in terms of economic characteristics. So what are the underpinnings of a industry and a business? And document storage / records management was a champion in terms of economic characteristics. Not perfect, but a champion. So one of the really compelling facts about this industry was that there are contractual recurring revenues. So customers signed multi-period contracts on a take or pay basis. So that's a godsend. For young, first-time, inexperienced entrepreneurs, as I was. But when you have 99.5% visibility on next month's revenue or next year's revenue, that is a dream for an entrepreneur to wake up with on the first of the month or on New Year's Day. And we had that. So contractual recurring revenue with multi-period take-or-pay, auto-renewing contracts, like, it was just so good. It was really, really good. We had virtually no maintenance CapEx. So we didn't have to reinvest in the business to maintain the current revenue streams. We had to invest lots of capital to grow the revenue streams, but not to maintain. So that's good, but not outstanding. We had phenomenal operating leverage. So the next customer tended to come in at extraordinarily accretive contribution margins. So that is super exciting once you figure out those unit economics. We had the ability to raise price with a very, very high probability of stick rate. And I've done some work around price increases. And you know, price increases are an extraordinarily powerful tool. And the ability to raise price consistently at modest rates over very long periods of time creates an incredible amount of equity value. And we had that channel there. And finally, customers didn't leave. So our customer retention rates were you know, we used to talk about being greater than 100% because current customers gave us more documents to store every year. So if we got no new customers, we grew in sort of high single digit, low double digit rates every year without getting a single new customer. I mean, that's a phenomenal place to be. So those are sort of the geeky, wonky underpinnings. More personally, it was just fun. I mean, we had forklifts, we had trucks, we had big warehouses. I mean, it was cool. When my kids came to my office, they were excited. It was fun to see the equipment, and I loved the people. Like, this was a blue collar-ish old economy type of business. It just felt so cool to watch people grow and develop and embrace what we were trying to do. And finally, when I got involved in the industry, it was not highly professionalized. And being in a business that isn't highly professionalized, but the model's been proven, is a wonderful place to be. It means you're not taking sort of proof of concept risk, but there's an extraordinary runway to build and be part of the professionalization of the industry. So this was a great, great industry. And that was proven by the fact that there have been many, many winners. And ideally, you want to be in an industry where everyone's a winner. I'd rather be average in a phenomenal business than extraordinary in a mediocre business. So when there are lots of winners, it increases the probability of everyone's success. So this was a wonderful place to be as a young first-time entrepreneur.
I have so many questions rattling around about your response, and I think I have to go with this one just before I forget, which is, what makes some industries or businesses prone to creating multiple winners versus some that are ultra competitive and winner take all?
Wow, that is a good question. I think industries where you could build some type of geographic moat, industry specialization moat, but there's something protective about the nature of your franchise within the industry is a good place to be. Industries with multiple winners have great economic characteristics. So you can't be in an industry with everybody as a winner and it be a bad industry. And that was certainly the records management industry. So winner take all, customers tend to not be sticky and can migrate to the winner. Winner take all might mean that your moat really isn't that protective. But this was an industry where it almost felt like cable TV in the 70s or 80s, where every major city had one to three players, and that was it. It was sort of like this federation of independent operators that had their own, I certainly don't want to use the word monopoly because that's not true, but their own sort of geographic protected franchise. And once customers signed up, they tended to be very, very sticky, and that dissuaded new entrants from coming in. So lots of factors that coalesced around this being a industry that produced many, many winners.
Yeah, when was this, and what led you into this industry?
Yeah, so you're going to embarrass me now because I'm dating myself. I got involved in the industry in the early 90s and exited the industry in 2007. So that, and that was part of the golden moment of this industry. It's still a very good industry, but maybe not as compelling. Doesn't mean it's bad. It's just, it means it was extraordinary and now it's very good. And that's different. Yeah, that's slightly different.
That kind of leads me to my next question, which was going to be, how has the industry evolved over the years as things have become a lot more digitally native? I mean, and I say this selfishly because we have, in our office, we have way too many filing cabinets and need to digitize things yesterday. So I'm just curious, how has the industry changed over the years, and, you know, how did that affect y'all's business?
Yeah, Benton, I'm not an expert anymore because I'm not in the industry. So this is just my conjecture. But what's tended to happen is that the organic growth rates of the business, especially from current customers providing new documents to store, has atrophied with time. And the business has become predominantly storage and less service, which isn't a horrible fact, but customers not growing as much is a bad fact. So more static revenue streams with current customers providing less new material. And that's because now when you originate information, you might not ever hit the print button, where in a decade or two ago, you hit the print button a lot, but that's not quite the case anymore. Still very, very good, but not necessarily extraordinary.
For sure, for sure. I want to go back a few minutes where you mentioned, you know, when your kids would come to the office, there were forklifts, there were, you know, there's documents everywhere, storage going on. What was your role in all of this? Were you, you know, I'm sure maybe you drove a forklift every now and again, but like, talk us through what your role was, how it changed over the years, and maybe some lessons that you learned along the way.
Yeah, great question. I feel like I had multiple lives running the business. So I think about this, not unique to me, but generically, as entrepreneurs going through three stages, usually in their evolution, and that's doer, manager, and leader. You could also think of it as sort of infancy, adolescence, and adult. But the things you do when you sort of have a nascent microscopic business are very, very different than when you employ lots of people and have geographic spread. So initially I was a doer. I did everything. So literally deliveries, pickups, sales, accounting, you know, anything that needed to be done, I was the person that did it. When you start a business, that's the way it goes. As we grew, I became a manager of doers. So I was directing people who provided tasks for the organization. And then as the organization continued to grow even further, I was a leader of both managers and regional managers and executives that were coaching and working with the managers and doers. So it's sort of this evolution of actually doing tasks to much more amorphous tasks of being a leader. And the world feels very, very different when you literally know everyone's name and know what they had for lunch, to a place where not only did you not hire everybody, but you don't know their name and you've never met them. So that you know, managing and leading are two very, very different things. And I think running any type of small, medium business isn't that hard if you stay in the stage. So it's not hard to be a doer, that we think of that really as a shop. And it's not hard to be a manager in a small little business that isn't dynamic. And it's not even hard to be a leader in a more complex, tricked out organization. What's incredibly challenging and grueling, and many people fail at doing, is crossing the bridge from infancy to young adult to adult, or doer, manager, leader. Not only are you sort of ripping down the organization and rebuilding the organization for a new chapter, but you have to be brutally honest. You might not have the next skill set or temperament to be in the right place. So yeah, I think I had three different roles and they were all fun. I mean, it's really, really cool to have done everything and have that intimacy and granular knowledge of the business. That gives you a lot of power and authority when you're talking to drivers or customer service people, because you literally know what they're doing.
Yeah, wow.
Do you think that search funders who acquire businesses that already have decent scale like run into trouble by potentially missing that doer stage?
Yeah, not sure. I mean, I think there are pros and cons of all these approaches. So, you know, knowing what I know now, I wish I didn't do the doer stage, because that was multiple years at a Caterpillar's pace. So the beautiful thing about the search fund is you sort of buy your way into first base. You buy your way into the manager position and shortcut the riskiest and most time consumptive chapter, which is the first mile. There are pros and cons, Victor. It's not debilitating that they don't do it, but they have to make up in other ways. But I think where I really excelled and where the organization came together is when we were at scale. We had a little bit more girth than scale. And I was really spending most of my time on the programmatic acquisition strategy. We did 38 acquisitions to help grow and build the business, lots of capital formation in conjunction with that. But that was really the, you know, one of the defining elements of my role. And is really figuring out that programmatic acquisitions were a way for us to accelerate the business in a very prudent and accretive way.
You've written a lot about a lot in the SME space, but I can't say I've read all of it, but I've read a very good chunk of it. And I don't know if you've written about making those transitions between doer, manager. Have you written about that?
Yeah, there's a case note called The Evolution of a Search Fund CEO.
Okay. I've seen that one. I've not read it, but I would love to ask you about that and how you know when it's time and what is the process from going from A to B to C?
Yeah. Well, look, this is such a huge question and issue. How do you think about the evolution of an organization, and what's the pace of growth? And do you front load infrastructure, or do you try to time in infrastructure coincidentally, or does infrastructure and talent trail? I mean, these are massive questions to think about when you're building and scaling an organization. Look, most of the people you probably interact with and I interact with want to grow the business. So then the question of pace sort of manifests itself. And what is the right pace in which to grow an organization, either organically or inorganically? And I think that's a really conscious decision. I don't think you want to grow as fast as you can all the time under all circumstances. That might be imprudent. I think you want to grow within the control of the organization, within the infrastructure you currently have established, and within the capital structure that you have in place. And if you're outstripping the infrastructure, you're outstripping the capital structure, the bridge might collapse, or it might be less graceful crossing the bridge. And crossing the bridge is really, really hard. So I'm not sure it's ever really graceful, but if you do it at an imprudent pace or without the right infrastructure, without the right capital components in place, the bridge might be more wobbly. So how do you think about it? Look, I think growth is an intentional choice. And in conjunction with growth, you have to think about where are the right underpinnings of the business, the systems, the processes, the infrastructure, and the people that you have in place, and when you're outgrowing it. And if it doesn't feel a little bit elegant, I'm not sure it feels elegant every day or perfect every day, but generally a business should feel like it's in a state of flow. And if it feels like you're fighting everything every day, you don't have the right systems, processes, or maybe people. And it is totally natural and humbling, and it can be very painful to have to change systems, processes, and people as you move from doer, manager, leader, or sort of scale the business from infancy, young adulthood / adolescence to more maturity in adulthood. You have to drop some people that no longer fit or are capable of being on the team, and you have to reload a whole bunch of systems and processes.
Were there any lessons that you learned going from doer to manager to leader? It sounded like you made a comment that there were some local players most in most markets for document storage. So that sort of led itself to a programmatic acquisition strategy versus an organic growth strategy. Were there any lessons that you took away from the different stages that you were in?
Yeah, so we grew organically in addition to acquisitions. Acquisitions sound sexier. It really isn't, but people like to talk about acquisitions. But we did grow organically as well. What lessons did I learn? I'm sort of a mild believer in trying to front load infrastructure. So getting the right systems and processes and people in place, not miles ahead of time, but ahead of time, and then growing into it as compared to trying to do it concurrently with the growth or behind the curve. Trying to catch up on systems and processes is very, very painful. And I'd rather be just a little bit ahead so you feel like you have capacity to grow the business than running to catch up. I mean, that was a key lesson. I feel like I spent so much of my time on systems and processes and making sure we had the right infrastructure in place to allow the business to grow. And we were constantly professionalizing the business. I think I'm a huge fan of outsourcing. So things that you can outsource to somebody that could do it better than you is usually a wise decision. So we were good at, a few things that really drove our success, but we didn't have to be good at everything. And if we could outsource or partner with someone who was better than us at something, that was a smart thing to do. I don't know if that's helpful.
That's super helpful.
I'm looking at my notes. I prep for this, but another thing I see that I think a big learning point in the Archives One story, which should be motivating and empowering to people, is you could build a really dynamic, exciting organization in a very simple and boring business. Don't confuse sort of the veneer and patina of the business with the excitement of growth or the economic engine of the business. And, I used to joke, if I went to either a dinner party or barbecue or a cocktail party, an excellent way to stop the conversation was to tell someone you were in the document storage business. I mean, that usually cut off the conversation very quickly, but I loved it. I mean, it was a ton of fun for me, and I just couldn't wait for every day to start because I felt like I had this great laboratory to experiment with, and things were humming and clicking, and it was just a ton of fun in a simple, boring business.
I think that, I work at a technology company now, and about two or three years ago was when I was first introduced to the writings of people like Brent Beeshore, and got really interested in this SMB world and then ETA. I think that throughout reading various writings there, I realized that there was a lot of exciting opportunity in boring businesses. So that's been kind of a revelation to me. I'm interested to hear from you. I would imagine that you have many students who are interested in pursuing their passion, and their passion might not align with like businesses that have very strong economic characteristics. And I think that millennials especially struggle with this. And like, I feel like I kind of live in a passion economy where people want to be Instagram influencers and things like that. So I'm just kind of curious, like, how do you, or what are some things that you might talk to a student about to kind of sway them in the right direction?
Yeah, I don't think there's a right direction universally. I think there's a right direction for each person. And I wrote a case note on the nature of passion in an entrepreneurial journey. And it's on my bio page. I think there are three ways to tap into passion. And I believe passion is a prerequisite to be a successful entrepreneur. But there are three types of passion. There's product passion. I love the thing I do and make. There's process passion. I love building and growing and architecting an organization and a dynamic company. And there's purpose passion. I love the impact I'm making in the world. None are right or wrong. Most entrepreneurs probably draw from all three, but there might be a predominant one that's driving each individual entrepreneur. I am clearly a process guy. Most ETA search fund entrepreneurs are process passion centric. They are really excited about leading, building, growing, architecting, operational excellence, best in the industry. That's what's driving them. I somewhat joke. There are always students that come to me who say, hey, I want to open up a organic vegan cupcake business in Brooklyn. And I sort of joke and smile like you hit every cliche. And there's nothing wrong with that. If that's your thing, I want to help you achieve your thing. But let's jump into it eyes wide open and understand the choices you're making around the probability of success. Doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. Just understand what's driving you and whether you're making a decision about a lifestyle or a product that you're in love with, or you're making a decision about economic outcomes.
I love that. And it's super helpful for me. I'll be starting my full-time MBA in August. So
Wife and I, where are you going, yeah, Victor?
I'm going to Kenan Flagler. So I actually just moved up to UNC about a week ago. And so
congratulations.
Really excited about it. So obviously, Benton and I have this podcast that's more or less about ETA. I'm very interested in ETA. I don't know for sure if in 2 years it'll be the route that I pursue, but I think that it's a high likelihood. What are some, and I know you've written about this, but I think that our listeners will greatly appreciate it as well. But what are some things that you think that I or other MBA students should be doing, or skills they should be developing while earning their MBA if ETA is the route that they think they want to pursue?
Okay. So let me try to address that more generally. And I don't want you to think I'm plugging things I've written, but I've thought about so much of this, and I write stuff because I joke I'm a middle-aged guy, I have something to say. But I wrote a case note, some advice to graduating MBA students, which might be helpful on this note.
Definitely.
I think the most important thing to think about during your MBA program, Victor, is finding your voice and your leadership style. So you should graduate from business school with a really defined compass of where you're going. And your leadership style and your voice can be different from Benton's, and you could both be right. So really sort of finding out in the MBA program what you are going to be as a leader or an entrepreneur. I think it's also crucial to leave business school with a really firm set of values Life becomes so much easier when you have defined values, because things can become quick yeses or nos if they align with your values or not. And business school might be the last time for a while that you have this opportunity to breathe and think and really ruminate about sort of who you are and what you want your life to be. So I think you should leave with a defined set of values, some sense of what your leadership style and voice is going to be, and fill your toolkit up. So the tactical part of business school is really understanding financial analysis, industry selection, customer selection, operations, negotiation, but really thinking about filling up your toolbox with all these different tools. I also encourage students all the time in my classes to think of their MBA experience, definitely my classes, as a laboratory. This is a really, really good place to fail. So lean in, you know, in class, make the comment that you're not sure if it's whether it's correct or not. That's the perfect place to test out an idea, because the safety net is high. The safety net is not high when you graduate. You're dealing with your time and your money, or your life and your career. So business school is a great place to test out your ideas in class and get piled on by faculty members and your peers, but the consequences are low. If you're thinking about doing a search fund in your MBA, I wrote something, how to launch your search fund during your MBA. But if you're thinking about doing that, I think course selection matters. So obviously take the ETA courses, any courses that lean towards small and medium business. I think connecting with investors, entrepreneurs in the ETA space early is important. I think reading everything you can read, even if it's not on syllabi, but this is your life, so read everything you can read outside of class about the ETA world. And then try to get internships with ETA entrepreneurs, either searching or operating, as early as possible. And that's the best way to test whether this path is potentially for you or not, by shadowing someone that's doing it.
What are some ways that I could actually go about finding my voice and my leadership style while earning my MBA?
Yeah, so I think about this as you're going to take a whole bunch of classes. You're going to see a whole bunch of faculty members. They're going to be guests on campus all the time, protagonist guests. You're going to have peers at the school, and you're going to get this fire hose of information, and you're going to get to pick different pieces of all these people you encounter that you want to replicate or reject. And it's this incredible buffet of different leadership styles in all the protagonists, all the guest speakers, all the faculty members. And you get to say, I want to be like him or her, or I would never want to be like him or her. And you start to pick and piecemeal together what your version of leadership is. But I would encourage you to be conscious about that and deliberate. It's just an amazing window where you get to see all these different approaches, and you're going to get to feel which one fits for you and make it your own. You don't have to replicate anyone in totality, but you get to beg and borrow and steal from lots of different people and make it your own, which is really cool.
Very cool. Thank you.
AJ, when we first spoke over the phone about, you know, potentially doing a podcast, you mentioned, and you also mentioned it here, about values and figuring out what you really value most, either during your MBA, but during those times, like, how did you figure out your values, what you're trying to optimize for? I think when we spoke, you were very much a family man. You wanted to have control over your time, which are two things that I value a lot. I know Victor values a lot as well. How did you figure that out and arrive at that conclusion? And then how did you actively, like, try and structure your life during, you know, Archive One, for example, to achieve those results, if you will?
Yeah, Benton, I can't say I did everything well. So I think I've evolved both as an entrepreneur and a person. So I'm not sure when I was a young, aspiring, hungry entrepreneur, I did everything well. I'm not sure I had a great set of values when I came out of business school. I always knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I always knew I wanted to own my own business and not work for someone else. So, you know, I saw myself on that path from a relatively early part of my life, and gravitated towards that. But when I was building my business, I'm not sure I was a great dad or husband all the time. I could be the jerk at the soccer game on the phone the whole time. So I was physically there, but I wasn't mentally there. I had a lot of my identity and ego wrapped up in the business. And for whatever reason, I'm not going to say this is right or wrong, but I just so badly wanted the business to be tenable and successful that I poured everything into the business, sometimes to the detriment of other parts of my life, which is not healthy. I am not saying to replicate what I did. I will say that sometimes to be successful at anything, whether it's athletic, musical, academic, business, you might have to overinvest in one component of your life for at least a window. The important thing is to know when to move on. One thing I did, which I'm proud of, I don't want to say proud of, one thing I did which was important to me when I was running Archives One is I literally had a travel budget. So I gave myself permission to travel a certain number of days a month. It wasn't a financial budget. It was a nights away from home budget. And if I started to exceed that consistently, my role at the company needed to be cleaved. And I had to hire someone else to do part of what I was doing, so I wasn't traveling so much. Now, when I traveled, if I woke up at 4 a.m. to take a 7 o'clock flight to Chicago to have a lunch meeting, but I was home by 7 o'clock at night, that was not a travel day because I was home for my kids under normal circumstances. But if I didn't sleep in my own bed, that was a travel day. And that's a really good way to test your marriage and family quickly if you're not at home. So I wrote some notes because you prepped me with some questions in advance. I would say family is forever. So business is not forever. More than likely, your business at some point will end. It'll either end really well or it won't end well. But businesses tend to end, even though I'm a huge fan of long-term holds, but businesses tend to end and family is forever. So just think about where you're allocating time and emotion, because family is going to be permanent and the business will not be. And something I've done some work around is good outcomes after an entrepreneurial venture and bad outcomes after an entrepreneurial venture. And what's so amazing and fascinating to me is the words successful entrepreneurs use and the words failed entrepreneurs use are identical. And the words are lonely, isolated, bored, confused, self-doubt, adrift. So there's this malaise after you exit, even if it's an extraordinarily good exit. The words are the same for successful and failed entrepreneurs. And the prescription I offer as an armchair diagnostic is to make sure that when you're an entrepreneur, you keep other parts of your life alive and robust, family, friends, health, spirituality, outside interests, because those are going to run on and the business will either end good or it'll end bad, but it will end. And those other parts of your life are going to help you get through that transition of the business ending, either good or bad. And they truthfully just make you a more complete and whole person. I was a better CEO after I had kids because I understood what other people in the organization were managing. And before I had kids, I was probably not so sensitive.
Yeah, that's great. Another piece to the values equation is also someone's risk profile. And I know you've written about this in Patterns of Entrepreneurship and, you know, the various options that people have in becoming entrepreneurs. So how do you counsel your students to reflect not only on their values, but on their risk profile and what might be the best path for them?
Yeah, so I used this phrase earlier, sort of risk-adjusted lifestyle. So I try to get students to think about the probability of achieving the lifestyle they want to achieve. And when I say lifestyle, I don't mean consumption. I mean, do they want to be able to coach their kid's soccer team? Do they want to be home? Do they want to travel or not travel? But what entrepreneurial path gives them the highest probability of landing where they want to land? And what I try to coach students to think, most of my students graduate when they're 30. What I try to get them to think is, what do you want your life to look like when you're 40? So do you want to be working for someone else? Do you want to be home at 6 o'clock at night or doubling down for your second shift? Do you want to coach your kid's soccer team? Do you want to travel a lot for business? Do you want to travel a lot for pleasure? Do you want to have financial independence? Do you want to be engaged in your community? Do you want the work that you do to be a reflection of your vision, values, and what you care about? No right or wrong answers, but where do you want to be when you're 40? And if you're 30 today, what seeds are you planting to get to where you want to be when you're 40? And how are you going to get there? Which path of entrepreneurship is right for you to get to where you want to be when you're 40? And I obviously have my biases, but I think some of the venture-backed technology and cool consumer products have very binary outcomes. You're either a massive success or a failure. And you raise lots of capital, and there are lots of other people engaged in the company, and many bosses, and 100 miles an hour, and not good or bad. If that's what you want, that's great. I try to paint a picture to my students that if you're fortunate enough to own a material part of a $1 million EBITDA business to $25 million EBITDA business, that's a wonderful life. The work you do is a reflection of your strategy, vision, and values. You probably have financial independence. You get to be very impactful in the communities in which you operate. You get to impact your team members, which is what I call employees. It's a wonderful, wonderful way to live a life. And if you're a material owner in a $1 to $25 million EBITDA business, you don't have bodyguards. You can live what I would call a normal life and live like a prince or a princess in most cities. You're probably not a king or a queen. You're not the most important guy or gal in town, but you have an absolutely delightful life. And that's beyond financial. That's the sort of mosaic of what a life is or can be. And I try to get students to think about entrepreneurship fitting into their life. And I'm a huge fan of entrepreneurship. Like I get animated and excited about it, but it's just one part of who you are. And it's got to fit into your whole life. And which form of entrepreneurship you pick to engage in is sort of going to cast the die for how your life and your entrepreneurship life connect and intersect and what the interplay is. I mean, who wants to be 40 and sort of only have a professional self and not also have a personal self?
Yeah, I think maybe another good question to ask on the heels of the values and the risk profile question would be, you know, just given your experiences, would there have been things that you would have optimized for differently or done differently, just given your experiences? And maybe you hinted at some or not so much, but just curious, knowing what you know now.
Yeah, so great question. I was overly focused on optimizing around wealth creation as a young entrepreneur, possibly a reflection of my own insecurities. But I try to tell my students, you're all going to be wealthy. Some of you are going to be wildly wealthy quickly, and some of you aren't going to be as wealthy, and it'll take a longer time. But if you graduate from a school like Yale or any top business school, you're going to be wealthy enough. So relieve yourself of some of that burden. Don't feel like it has to happen very quickly in a burst. To build and nurture an organization that you set up for decades and decades, a very, very long holding period, because there's so much joy and fulfillment in leading and serving an organization. It's just a great place to be as part of an industry, a community, your company itself. And the mindset of building a business to exit undermines all that. So both from an economic perspective and an emotional perspective, I wish I set up an organization to exist for a very, very long period of time. And the entrepreneur's role within the organization might morph and evolve, but the foundation is there. And that probably, you know, once again, I don't want to make this about wealth creation, but it can drive more wealth creation. More importantly, I think it just gives you a wonderful perch and role in so many different parts of your life. So I wish I wasn't as hungry around wealth creation early and realized it could come slowly. And I wish, I would encourage entrepreneurs to think about setting up their organizations for multi-decade durations and how they think about that and what they can do to facilitate that. But I wish I knew that. I think playing at the intersection of personal and professional, those might be some of the biggest thoughts.
Yeah, I would say that's probably a great way to wrap up, Victor, unless you've got any questions to ask. I think what probably got Victor and I kind of going down this path to begin with was our sort of love for the Charlie Munger, Warren Buffett, long-term type thinking. And, you know, that runs a little bit orthogonal to kind of traditional private equity and even search funds, but to each their own, and everybody has a different right path, as you've said. So this is that was a perfect way to wrap up. I think we should have you on again to dive into the writings, if you're up for it.
Yeah, of course.
Well, in the interest of time, AJ, we want to be respectful to you. So we've got three quick questions for you. The first one is, to wrap up, is what does doing business the right way mean to you?
Yeah, I'm not sure I have a great answer for the other two questions, but this question I did think about. To me, doing business the right way, I tend to think about three constituents in business. I think about customers, team members, and shareholders. And doing right by any one is easy because you take from the other two. Doing right by all three is hard and very skillful. And I think of doing business the right way as having those three constituents in balance most of the time for very long periods of time. So your customers are excited about being part of your ecosystem, your team members are very excited about being part of your ecosystem, and your shareholders are grateful for the financial rewards that you're producing. That's hard, getting all three of those groups aligned and keeping the three legs of the stool in balance.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I feel like we could have a whole conversation on what that looks like in and of itself. So, but that's a great answer. Second one is, are there any personal habits or practices that you find helpful or that you're dedicated to, you know, to keep you either physically fit or mentally fit or just good for decompression purposes?
Yeah, I try to keep a lot of white space in my calendar, so blank time. And this is now, this is not when I was an entrepreneur, but now I try to keep white space in my calendar where I could be physically, emotionally available to family members and friends and parents. And I can be available without feeling like every minute of every day is already booked. That gives me time to think. It gives me time to write. And it gives me time to just be. So I do that. I think that's the tip I would share.
And finally, what business hasn't been started yet but needs to be? And another way of asking this is, if you could snap your fingers and solve one pain point, what would it be?
Yeah, I'm gonna pass on that. Well, that's a tough question. I don't know. I don't know if I'm not smart enough or not imagining enough, but that's a tough question.
It is.
I'm gonna pass on that one.
It is. Well, AJ Wasserstein, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. This was a blast. We're going to have you back, and I would love to dive deeper into your writing specifically. One of my favorite ones was the Programmatic Acquisition Strategies set. So that was really, really interesting to me, and I'm working through some of the other ones. As you say, they're not short reads, so I'm going to link to those in the show notes. But AJ, this was a blast.
Yeah, Ben and Victor, it's been a complete delight. Congratulations on the success of your podcast. Good luck on your entrepreneurial journeys and ventures. And if I could be helpful, I'd be thrilled.
Absolutely.
Thanks, AJ.
This is Benton here again. Thanks so much for listening to the Circle of Competence podcast. To find more episodes like this one, go to circleofcompetence.co. That's circleofcompetence.co to sign up for my weekly podcast emails, as well as a monthly summary of links to blog posts and articles I liked most from the previous month. Finally, if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a rating on iTunes, which will help more people discover the work we are doing to explore the entrepreneurial investor's journey. Thanks again for listening.